Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Bunker Show, coming to you live and direct from our secret bunker hidden beneath the sewers of Westminster, where we look into things that not many others look into. In the bunker, as always, is our sunshine, Helen, but she's lost her voice this week, so she'll be in the chat room, and she's telling me by sign language, if you want to ask any questions of our guest, to pop into the chat room and shoot the breeze with the people who are there, and we'll do our best to put them to our guest. As always, with us in the bunker, riding shotgun, here's Jimmy.
And always, I wouldn't have it any other way, mate. You know, it's great to be here, and I'm really, really looking forward to tonight's show. I think this topic is just going to be so interesting to so many people.
We're very, very lucky to have a big thinking guest who I personally love talking to and theorizing with. His name's Wei Chang. He's a neuroscience thinker, artificial intelligence designer, and author of a fantastic book called Quest. So, Wei, welcome to the bunker.
Hello, Fabrice. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, it's good to speak to you again. I've met you before, but I'm sure you're new to most of the audience to the Bunker Show. So how did you get started doing what you're doing?
Oh God, it's a long story, and it's in the book Quest, in the first chapters. It's basically, I started out on this little kind of quest to figure out how the brain works and to create artificial intelligence. This was in the late 80s. And I was inspired by a film called Blade Runner, funnily enough, which was inspired by, Ridley Scott was inspired by the movie Star Wars, which also heavily influenced me. So my life kind of deviated from the norm. I went to did a university thing, went to the kind of top university for AI in this country with the aim of doing a PhD. But 25 years ago, I discovered really the field of artificial intelligence as it was done back then wasn't really going anywhere. So I kind of went a bit of a deviant path, and it's been a long journey. But now here I am kind of heading back into the mainstream with this fractal brain theory to communicate. So it's been a funny unconventional kind of scholarly path, let's put it that way.
Yeah, because you had quite a number of other creative interests and artistic interests, as well as neuroscience. So that's probably giving you an interesting balanced approach rather than the mainstream academic approach. But how would you describe what it is that you do and your quest, as it were, that you write about in your book?
Well, really, in this kind of like deviating from the norm, I kind of ended up in kind of London's dark underbelly, land of kind of deviance, counterculture, squats and funny people and, kind of real just counterculture people working as a musician, drifting in from scene to scene, just really learning about life, really. And I guess the quest expanded because then I learned about things to do with consciousness in my little journey in this kind of subterranean world. And so the artificial intelligence brain kind of neuroscience little mission, little kind of Luke Skywalker, let's become the next Steve Jobs, Bill Gates little mission, kind of expanded into a kind of a journey into, who I was and having these experiences relating to consciousness. Interesting, at one of the universe experiences I had in my kind of mid-20s really kind of expanded my journey, if you get what I mean. So that really became an integral part of my path. And then later on, I was working in this church for 10 years, which was highly political. And that kind of really developed the kind of like this political awakening, where you actually in your workplace, you're in the same kind of space as people like Lord Rothschild, the Blairs came, all of New Labour was there at some point. Tony Benn, Corbyn was a regular. And you kind of like think about things, So in Piccadilly, where the church was, it was just kind of like, go for it, you can go for it.
So you can see, I guess, the psychological impact of the way in which people are open to different things at different times, open to different paradigms, different perceptions, and the fact that, I guess, each of us works with our own psyche whenever we engage with any kind of technology or any person, I guess.
Yeah, I'm kind of learning. you know, kind of drifting out of the mainstream and learning that, you know, basically how people are fixed in their kind of perspectives. And you really have to leave the mainstream and kind of, you know, deviate from the norm to have kind of more interesting experiences, to get more interesting perspectives on things, I suppose. And that's what I'm trying to kind of basically come back in and trying to communicate to the mainstream, is kind of like more interesting ways of looking at the world, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, hi, Wei. I think I get exactly what you mean, because, you know, the way you're describing your sort of development as a thinker, it kind of corresponds a lot to, you know, like cyberpunk and cyberpunk sensibility. I mean, how strongly would you relate to the whole cyberpunk aesthetic? You know, for myself, you know, like Blade Runner was a huge inspiration for me as an illustrator and comic writer, so I totally know where you're coming from. And it's interesting, don't you think, that, you know, society is actually following in a very parallel line as far as AI development is concerned, and also the way society is actually materializing?
That's completely right. It's funny, Jimmy, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, before my path deviated, I think I was influenced by the kind of music of the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix. I knew about this thing called psychedelia. But I think I was reading Philip K. Dick novels and reading this magazine called Mondo 2000, and actually reading this book called Siberia by Douglas Rushkoff, you know, quite early on in my journey, and then later on meeting all those people I read about in the book. I think that really, I mean, the cyberpunk thing, I guess, really influenced me in a kind of deep way. But it was really through, you know, like the music of the Beatles and probably Philip K. Dick novels, back to Blade Runner again, which kind of, I guess, pulled me towards that direction. Yeah, definitely.
So did that give you the I guess, that it helped with the ability to experiment with different worldviews or different tunnel realities, different perspectives through that exploration of art?
Well, to put it bluntly, Fabrice, I think, I was living in a squat and I was kind of obsessed by neuroscience. I was reading books about the amygdala, you know, books just about the amygdala, books just about serotonin, books about just about dopamine, you know what I'm saying, entire books. And I was, you know, basically really just living in this alternative reality of neuroscience. Anyway, if you're interested in psychedelic culture from what you've read, Philip K. Dick, of Beatles, etc., you can't resist to gravitate towards these kind of psychedelic substances. So basically, being outside of academia, I kind of became my own guinea pig. And I spent so much time reading about serotonin receptors, it was inevitable that I'd want to kind of, test my own, if you get my meaning. And that kind of like opened up a whole new part of the journey. I guess, you know, if you want to see it in mythological terms, I guess I entered into the land of the lotus eaters, you know, the first island on this is a little journey back home, if that makes sense. And I guess, you know, entering into the world of psychedelia in my 20s really was, a kind of catalyst, the kind of first stage of the mythological journey, the first island, the first port of call. So definitely, yeah.
Yeah, and it's quite an empowering thing to do, because obviously when you specialize in you know, one area or a number of fields, having that broad perspective or the broadness of possible perspectives obviously gives a different way of approaching your specialist fields. So, I mean, in terms of I guess it now probably be a good time to talk a little bit about the fractal brain theory and a little bit about what fractals are before we go on to recursive cognitive codes and such like.
Right. I mean, the main advantage of actually being outside of academia is the main disadvantage of academia. It's really specialized. Okay. So if to solve the problem of mind and artificial intelligence involves thinking out of the box, then it's very hard to think out of the box in academia, because the whole process of putting yourself in academia and specializing and becoming a, you know, PhD professor involves putting yourself into a box. You get my meaning. So actually being a free scholar, I just read whatever I like obsessively and kind of be my own supervisor. So I guess I came up with answers that other people in academia just would never come across, and do experiments and also do see things and experience things that you just would not experience in academia, living a nice kind of middle class existence as an academic. I think the fractal brain theory came about through a kind of, just loads of reading, tons and tons of reading about neuroscience and artificial intelligence and the mathematics of relevant mathematics, symmetry, kind of, you know, set theory, that kind of stuff, the mathematics of computation. But I was heavily influenced in the 80s, 90s. There was a kind of real fashion for things like chaos, complexity, and fractals. And I guess I got caught up with that. And I think, you know, you see fractals in the world, in the natural world, and, you know, city formation in the universe, you know, in kind of biological forms. And it's kind of like natural and almost like obvious that, you know, this kind of way of looking at things applies to the brain. Now, it's not completely obvious because, I mean, many people doubt that the brain is fractal. But, okay, let's explain what fractal means. Fractal means self-similar. It means that the parts of the objects reflect the whole. So like a tree is a classic fractal, like, you know, a bonsai, a little mini tree is like a big tree. So a branch of a tree is like the entire tree, and like a leaf has that same branching pattern like an entire tree. So that's a fractal. And like Russian dolls, if you have a big Russian doll next size down, say have like, you know, many dozens and dozens next size down, and each of those dolls have dozens and dozens next size down, it's kind of like a kind of recursive self-similarity. That's the word, self-similarity. So the kind of parts reflect the whole. So the basic idea is that the brain is exactly the same way. So on a kind of like a, you know, kind of microscopic level, the brain is neurons. It's trees, basically. You know, neurons are trees with arborizations, dendrites and axons. There's a way of conceptualizing the brain where you can actually conceptualize the entire brain at many scales, including the entire brain, as trees. And you can actually conceptualize your entire life as a tree of emanation from a fertilized egg to a kind of backward tree of emanation from your goals. So this way of looking at things is actually really flexible. And I think it's a really powerful way of creating artificial intelligence. And I think it's, you know, in this path, I've kind of used this fractal geometry, these ideas of symmetry, self-similarity, recursivity, to really just decompose the entire brain. And, you know, all the ideas from cognitive science, music, linguistics, spatial mapping, all that kind of stuff, and even genomics into one single unified theory. So this is what I'm kind of in the process of now communicating to wider society and mainstream science.
That's really crazy, actually, because as you're describing that, I actually wasn't visualizing it as a tree. I was visualizing what you're saying as a Mandelbrot set.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, we look at the Mandelbrot set, the fine magnifications at the edges. Basically, you have bifurcating trees, binary trees bifurcating out. The thing about the Mandelbrot set is basically, you know, the big kind of like meditating Buddha shape. You know, like two circles. It looks like a meditating Buddha on its side. Well, that meditating Buddha, there's an infinite number of them nested inside the Mandelbrot set. It's like doing like Russian dolls again.
And that has, you know, its basis in mathematics. And, you know, with fractals, as you say, you know, the branch is very similar. It functions and it reoccurs. It repeats itself in the same way as the twig that comes off that branch. And,
exactly,
you know,
yes.
And so it applies the a similar sort of dynamics or code. So
exactly. I mean, the point about the Mandelbrot set is that these infinite snowmen, it's been mathematically proven. I don't know exactly how they prove that. It must have been quite intricate proof. But the infinite snowmen, they branch off the main snowman like in a tree structure. Isn't that beautiful? You can imagine really the main snowman is like the celestial Buddha. And all the little snowmen are like mini Buddhas, you know what I'm saying? Like all the entities in the universe. And that's captured in the Mandelbrot set. So completely fractal.
Yeah, and the Mandelbrot set for me, and it's a little bit like the Child of Humanity. It's made up of 7.5 billion other people who grow and live and exist at different rates. But it's an interesting analogy or model, I guess, that kind of springs from the Mandelbrot set.
It's called a fingerprint of God. It's quite profound, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but in some ways, it's the with the fractal brain theory, it's the codes that come from that the brain seems to function in that recursive way.
Right.
And you know, in terms of you know, having a neural pathway switched on or switched off, and the effects of that, and you've put a theory to that seems to fit with quite a number of fields. So,
yes. Let me explain something important. What also important for the brain theory is that basically you need a mathematical language to unify all the separate fractals. So, you know, the idea of using fractals in neuroscience is nothing new, but all the fractals are disjoint. So with the basic language is basically binary trees and binary combinatorial codes and using to represent space and time. That sounds really simple, but, you know, what binary processes and language, music, representations, neurons are binary trees. And then, you know, in spatial mapping as well, but also even like mitosis, how brains come to being, you know, cell division is a binary process. Mitosis, one cell becomes two, becomes four, becomes eight, all the kind of 50 trillion cells in your body. But also progenitor field formation, you know, how you, the different areas of your body and brain come to being is also binary. So it's a really powerful language. And it's also the language, you know, information theory and the language of computation that physicists are using to describe the universe now. So I think it's that's the kind of like intermediate step which I've introduced to capture all these separate fracticalities. Now, binary trees sound really simple, but the thing is, I mean, a lot of people don't understand or are probably unaware that all mathematics reduces to what's called discrete mathematics. Okay, to cut a long story short, it's basically set theory, logic, and Boolean algebra. That's discrete mathematics. Now, all the structures of logic and Boolean algebra, they're basically binary trees, and all the relations of set theory are basically binary. So, okay, it goes further, because then discrete mathematics, in turn, reduces to what's called formal axiomatic systems, okay? In the mathematization of the brain theory, what I've done is actually, you know, reducing discrete mathematics to binary trees. In a sense, what I've done is actually figure out the simplest, most minimal formal axiomatic system they can possibly be. And it's one that this is the breakthrough step of the fractal brain theory. If you want to actually find one really innovative step that really pushes the boundaries, it's basically recursive self-modification. Now, many people in artificial intelligence, they know that recursive self-modification is really important, but no one knows how to do it. So one of the kind of breakthrough ideas of the brain theory is recursive self-modification. So many people, you know, AI researchers think that recursive self-modification happens at a certain level of complexity. And it's, you know, much talked about technological singularity is the process of recursive self-modification involving the entire planet, the entire, you know, world, kind of industrial, scientific, technological base, entire world, society, and political economy. That's the technological singularity. It's huge. It's massive. But what the fractal brain theory does, it shows that recursive self-modifications happens at a very atomic level of the bit. Do you understand what I'm saying? The simplest formal axiomatic system, you make it recursively self-modifying, you can generate discrete mathematics, you can generate genomics, you can generate the brain, you can generate mind from that simple seed. I know it sounds, you know, completely outlandish, but when you realize that basically we come from a recursive self-modifying function called a fertilized egg. Does that make sense?
It shows, you know, biologically, it, how that functions. It's interesting because if you think in one particular way and you practice a particular mode of, for example, navigation, some people can if they taxi drive through complex cities like London, will develop the parts of the brain, even at quite an advanced age. So, you know, with that neuroplasticity, and that's probably recursive behavior. Obviously, if you practice going from A to B, then
as you
get more knowledge, you're going to have that feedback loop. And, you know, it seems that it works in that way. You know, if you have cells or mutations biologically, depending on how functional they are.
Completely.
I guess will be whether they, you know, persist or not.
Well, no, we all kind of know intuitively that kind of learning is recursive self-modification, that we basically go into a language class, learning to drive a taxi, learning the streets of London. It's basically you're recursively self-modifying yourself. And we also know that, you know, the ability to modify, we improve on that ability. It's like an idea from the kind of 21st century view of evolution, these kind of cutting edge ideas in the theory of evolution, mainly coming from molecular biology, the idea that evolution evolves evolvability. So this is actually really, this idea of recursive self-modification isn't just for AI and for understanding learning. but he can't understand from the 21st century perspective. He can't understand evolution. I'm talking, the theory of evolution of animals, species and stuff without recursive self-modification. Because the actual recursive, the recursive tree of descent, the recursive process of creation of species, the actual function recursively self-modifies itself. So the output of evolution then feeds back on itself to create more complex forms. And also, obviously, ontogenesis, the fertilized egg, the new epigenetic data and information, basically the fertilized egg, if you see DNA and the genome as a function, then as the fertilized egg becomes, or the cells in the body, then the actual genome, epigenetically, the function is recursively being self-modified. So it's a really powerful concept. In fact, what I think I've done in the past few months is really when you distill form axiomatic systems, the kind of most kind of like fundamental level of mathematics, and stick in this recursive self-modifying loop. Essentially, what we have, if it explains the brain, genomics, evolution, and the mind, is really what Chomsky's universal grammar. So back to Chomsky again. I think, in all seriousness, I think what he's been questing for all his life is really this most minimal form axiomatic system that recursively self-modifies itself and generates language. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. Because that would show a natural way in which our psyches, our consciousness develops, and also, I guess, mutates and evolves, whether that
in a completely kind of recursive way. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So it's kind of, yeah. So. So the kind of brain theory has kind of, moved on in the past, funny, in the past year and a half, even since we last chatted in Brighton last year. It's kind of it's galloped ahead. I mean, this is what I quit my full-time job to do, the past year and a half, just to really get things ready for, for prime time, I suppose, to introduce it into the mainstream, which is right now.
And, with such things as, I guess, universal grammar, back in the day, Robert Anton Wilson was talking about English prime, not using the word is. How with the minimum of clutter that fractal system can function with less inhibition, I guess. So if you put constraints on that fractal system through judgment or any other, I guess, brain program, that can affect its natural fractal flow, I guess.
Anton Wilson has some amazing ideas. I remember years ago, a friend giving me a copy of Cosmic Trigger, and I was reading it. I was thinking, I was 21, 22, just came out of university. I just, just came out of the squat scene, and I didn't really understand it. I didn't really understand the synchronicity business. I didn't really understand this kind of, cosmic intelligence business at that point. And if further down the line, funnily, my entire life became one synchronicity trail. Maybe it was reading that book, Cosmic Trigger, that made it, but
yeah,
I saw 23 everywhere.
Yeah, and it is interesting, and it's partly due to the attention and focus of the consciousness looking out for synchronicities and observing them as cosmic glue, indicators of whether you're going with your flow, or indicators of things to be aware of, and I guess part of that neuro-linguistic programming loop can have an effect on how that mind develops, or how it metaprograms, how it programs itself.
Right. I'll tell you what I believe. Go for it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, society steps in at a very, very early age to stunt that, natural intuitive progression, don't they?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, completely. In school, yeah, completely. You have to rediscover it, don't you? And you rediscover it by leaving society, leaving the mainstream.
It'd be interesting, you know, to I guess observe some of the parallels with the development of AIs at this point, in because, you know, society and convention, our own neurolinguistic programming can often have an effect, you know, how practiced we are at different things can often have an effect on the neuroplasticity, productivity of the brain, you know, how well we develop and grow with our consciousness. Are there those kind of restrictions that have been sort of placed on AI development, or is the fractal model becoming, you know, more accepted or more tried and tested with you know, AI development?
Okay, this is probably a longer answer to your question, but it's what we were talking about earlier on. I mean, you know, the idea of synchronicities is the idea that what I think is that basically the universe converges to set conclusions. So, you know, even scientists talk about destiny wave functions, you know, that there's a kind of, you know, quantum wave function coming from the future that kind of emanates backwards in time and kind of pulls history, the entire world history, cosmic history, towards it to create a kind of end state. So world history kind of converges to a point, and that's why we have synchronicities, because the dice are loaded. So I think is basically that we're taught to be like robots in school, to really just get a job and to, you know, watch mainstream media and to switch off. But if you open your kind of mind to these kind of signals, there really are signals from the universe. I mean, you know, New Age folks would call it intuition, your higher mind, I guess. And I think that's when the universe, these kind of like signals from the future pull us. But you have to be willing to receive those signals and have to be open and not kind of roboticized. But I think also AIs will be in this kind of mesh. I guess that's one of the big issues of this age, you know, creating AIs and they go run amok. I think the you know, Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, they have a point, and that's a very dangerous technology. But I think if we can kind of, you know, kind of create artificial intelligence and kind of mesh them in a kind of like to kind of pursue human purposes, that's the main trick, really. I think, you know, the whole question of kind of runaway AIs, the technological singularity that goes bad, is a very kind of imminent possibility, imminent danger, really. But I think also maybe some of the mainstream thinkers, they missed the point in that it's not about creating friendly AI or, you know, kind of smiley AI, or even getting committees to make sure that AIs aren't used for warfare. Because I think if your society is warlike, if you're, you know, the corporation that owns you is actually based in a kind of war economy, then I think it's irrelevant whether you've got a committee to, you know, decide that your inventions aren't going to be used for war.
So I guess it's...
If your society is evil and corrupt anyway, if we can't even keep an eye on, you know, politicians we have now, then I think it's hopeless to, you know, do the same for AIs. So I think that the solution really is wider. You need to really kind of use this thinking to really try and fix. Really kind of sort out and kind of maybe make kind of improvements on a kind of wider political social situation.
So I guess that people.
I was going to say. When you were just speaking, then have you seen that movie Ex Machina?
Oh yeah. I thought it was quite slow pace, but
it was really slow pace. But it kind of I thought its point was kind of what you were touching upon just then. You know, like how, you know, the AI is going to reflect the nature of the society, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yes. I think it's hopeless to try and kind of sandbox AI and think, you know, society is all right. Therefore, if we make them, you know, kind of friendly, therefore they'll come out in the world that's going to be, they'll be friendly AIs. I think they'll basically be used for the purposes of the society that they're created in. So I think if you want to avoid a situation of, you know, tyranny by AIs, then you have to sort out the problem of tyranny by human beings first, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so, you know, if you've got people throwing their excrement at each other, or monkeys throwing their excrement at each other in trees, to mark out their territory and their approval or disapproval of other packs of monkeys, then if you've got human beings who mark out their ink excretions on things called maps and treat them the same way, and instead of flinging their excrement or flinging, you know, radioactive depleted uranium, you're still not going to solve the quintessential, you know, base barbarity line.
Well, of course, I mean, we say the NSA, I mean, you know, the Snowden affair, basically, because Snowden was a human being and he kind of did a natural human thing to expose corruption and, you know, what was going on against the public interest. I mean, what they're trying to do in NSA is basically take humans out the loop. You know what I'm saying? That's a major intelligence agency. So then what you have is basically almost like the recipe for Skynet. So if you've got this intelligence agency that snoops on the entire planet and it's all controlled by AIs because humans can't be trusted anymore because of, these kind of like shadow governments don't like people like Snowden. They want AIs in charge. If you can't sort that out, then it's irrelevant. If you know, the ideas of Elon Musk worrying about existential risk, if your actual institutions, your kind of powers that be are already implementing things that are going to lead towards Skynet anyway. So you really have to, that's one example of, you know, kind of institutions that are kind of corrupted, that aren't, you know, kind of publicly accountable, which are already using AI in this way, which is going towards kind of Terminator scenarios. And as I was saying, but, you know, if you can't control human tyranny, then it's irrelevant, this question of controlling machine tyranny.
So do you think there's, it's one thing that's come up in the bunker a number of times, is intelligence agencies acting without oversight. So do you think there's a need for groups like the NSA and GCHQ in this country to have more oversight of the systems that they're developing and using involving AIs or automated use of technologies?
Exactly. I mean, exactly. I mean, it's going to complete the point. I mean, you know, this idea that the intelligence agencies like the CIA, MI5, MI6 have this kind of autonomy and a lack of accountability is one recipe for human tyranny, for one, you know. And if you can't control your humans and they're, you know, kind of instituting these AI programs, then what hope of there is there of creating AI, you know, kind of controlling your AIs? So I think the solution is sort of part of a wider solution. You have to really kind of go over all of society. And maybe we talk about this later on in the talk, you know, this idea that you can use these ideas about the brain, about, you know, the idea of a brain theory, genome AI theory that extrapolates to the universe to kind of revitalize kind of like values which have been lost to do with equality, liberty, fraternity, meritocracy, accountability and stuff, you know, universal justice. So I think the package that I have in mind, kind of like, you know, my take on the whole thing about accountability and the whole existential risk of AI thing, I think the solution has got to be far broader than just trying to sandbox these AIs and hopefully, you know, that you can control them. Because if you're human beings already wanting to use these AIs for war and for, you know, surveillance and control, then it's very easy then for these AIs, if they're already out of the loop of, you know, oversight and control of wider society, to really just to, you know what I'm saying, just like an ex machina, ex machina, to kind of topple the CIA, whatever, NSA masters, and then we really will have Skynet. So I think it's going to be a kind of wider solution, definitely.
And I mean, with things such as AIs being bought and used more, and technology being used more, the evolutionary speed of technology increasing. Sure. Do you think that and I guess, you know, the fractal brain, fractal AI theory, do you think that's going to put pressure on certain elements of society? I mean, if you look at human beings anthropologically, when you have technology that often has social implications and societal implications as repercussions of that. And so do you think that understanding that and making that more widely available is going to lead to some subtler changes over length of time?
Well, I think this kind of technology has to be shared, because it has to be, you know, brought into the open, I think. And in and of itself, understand the brain and understand the mind, that's something really important. So I think it's something you can really suppress.
But I think the main thing is to get it out there and kind of just be aware of the dangers, and really to kind of, when you create AI, to kind of put safeguards in. But always with the kind of, like, you know, obviously if you create an AI, give it autonomy, give it weapons, give it a kind of ability to manufacture itself, give it its own power plant, then you're asking for danger, you know. So I think initially, at first, the AIs would be quite limited in their power. I don't think, you know, this Nick Bostrom scenario of, you know, hacker creates AI on his laptop that takes over the world in you know, a few days kind of thing. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think the uptake of this kind of technology is going to be very, very fast. It's going to be something quite rapid. At the same time, if you can actually associate with this message, this theory, this technology, something like a kind of Renaissance Enlightenment message that goes hand in hand with it, that leads to kind of, you know, social movements, social reform movements, I think that's really the way to go. And I think, and you know...
I was going to say, it's an interesting reflection back since I've been able to understand the fractal brain theory and the potential for how it works and what that means to me personally, my consciousness, my brain, and how I view that. It's given me a great number of tools to get the most out of myself.
Right.
And, you know, I think that is quite powerful. That's quite a powerful enlightenment, you know. Thank you very much, Ray.
Right.
We had a guest on about 3 weeks ago at the beginning of the month, Neil Sanders, who's an expert on mind control. And it was one of these things that came up, is privileged information or secret information. And I guess a lot of that seemed to relate very, very strongly the more I looked into the fractal brain theory and the ramifications for consciousness and metaprogramming, right, and, you know, being able to tune your own consciousness or your own mind and develop it. So,
right.
How do you think that you know, those elements will permeate through society, and how do you think they have done over, you know, the last year and a half since we spoke?
Okay. I mean, I guess the ultimate secret knowledge, which is actually probably shared by conspiracy theorists and the kind of supposed conspirators, and all through history, it's probably the biggest secret there is. It's probably the secret behind Freemasonry and you know, Rosicrucianism. Is this idea that somehow we're all one consciousness, that God is inside us, that somehow we can become one with God. So, you know, it's not just Dan Brown novels. I mean, it's, you know, the lost symbol. It's basically the truth behind esoteric religion. And so this is the biggest suppressed secret there is in history. And I think, you know, people think, esoterica and we're all one consciousness, how namby-pamby, how new age, how kind of, well, people don't understand, kind of, there's powers in this world, in the world of, you know, in the West, very, very significantly in the Muslim world, these kind of esoteric sects and kind of societies. And they may have forgotten even what they're about. They may, have, you know, funny, Freemasons write to me and they basically say, yeah, I read the Dan Brown novel. I had no idea we were about, you know, because I find a website, everyone's God. So I think the wider ramification of the fractal brain theory is its extrapolation to the universe. And once you do that, one, you can explain why there is these experiences of being one of the universe and why that makes sense. But also there's a kind of stronger proposition, which is actually that it allows us to explain in a way that's really rational. Okay, it takes some way, some kind of time to explain. It's in the book Quest, and it's on my website, how we're all one consciousness, basically. So that's the ultimate ramification of the brain theory. I mean, there's AI, there's, you know, there's technological singularity. But I guess the real kind of, like, you know, what happened in my journey was basically I had this experience, well, many times, this experience of being one of the universe or one with God. And it's quite common, you know, it's not the kind of rare thing now. Funny, David Icke, you know, he's an interesting guy. He gets some things wrong. He gets lots of things right. I think he's a brave guy, but I kind of, it's slightly funny for me when he kind of says in his long lectures that, you know, reveals most amazing, fantastic ideas that are really controversial. And in the end, he'll say, oh, yeah, and there's this really controversial thing you're absolutely not going to believe. And he talks about, you know, infinite consciousness, that, you know, he's experienced infinite consciousness. Well, some of the scenes I've kind of gone through in my life, in my 20s especially, I knew people who did infinite consciousness every weekend. So, you know, so it's quite a common experience. And I, in my travels and my talks, in my, you know, kind of like interactions on the internet, people write to me, I realize now that this, you know, one consciousness thing is actually really a strong idea, and it's out there. It probably is believed by your major league conspirators. It's believed by conspiracy theorists, you know, one consciousness, infinite consciousness. But, you know, there's these massive powers that be almost waiting for a signal. If someone can actually bring this truth to the fore, I think this hidden knowledge is really the, apart from artificial intelligence and singularity, is really the thing that can really turn things around in this world. Seriously. You know, he's got a mystical sect in Islam. They're waiting for some kind of revelation. If you can actually explain it, there's something behind it, like a definitive theory of mind, brain, genome, AI, the universe, and actually, you know, just bring it out for the 21st century. That's the real, you know, unveiling of the hidden thing, if you get my meaning, the apocalypse.
Oh, no, I totally get your meaning. And it's really interesting because, you know, you're hitting up on points where, you know, like, it's completely suggested through, you know, like, commonalities and psychedelic experiences.
But
the fractal mechanics of the universe are quite apparent at some points. And, you know, it's just a basic commonality, you know. Anybody can say whatever they want to say about, you know, like psychedelic experiences. But, you have to agree with is that it does open up your mind to the possibilities that, you know, like things can actually work on an exponential level. You know, I really can't. Yeah. I'm getting where you're coming from, mate.
No, completely. It's funny. I mean, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Page, you know, of Google and Facebook and Elon Musk, they all go to Burning Man. So, you know, Burning Man, the big kind of Glastonbury of America. So if they keep going, they're going to have the same kind of ideas, same kind of, you know, kind of sentiments as we're discussing now. So I think, you know, this kind of like movement based on kind of, you know, these kind of esoteric experiences partly brought on by psychedelic drugs, I think it's going to be a major, could be de factor that can really, you know, make the difference in this, in what's going on in the world right now.
But yeah, and don't you think, you know, you think back to the Summer of Love, and you think about the social dynamic, think about the actual social dynamic of a rave, the peaceful, you know, like the peaceful togetherness that everybody experienced, and you know, like, that was just, you know, like that particular mindset's actual basic shared understanding of the way life could work quite perfectly made flesh. You know, it's funny how authority clamped down on all that.
Well, if it's not the children of Woodstock that brought about the great change, I mean, the children of Woodstock became the establishment in a sense. I mean, you know, people like Corbyn, people like Saunders, if they didn't directly, you know, take psychedelic drugs, they came out of that whole wave of sentiment that was partly, no, to a very large extent, fueled by the whole 60s, 70s, you know, like psychedelic thing, I believe, in a very strong way. So if it wasn't the children of Woodstock, I guess it's going to be the children of the children of Woodstock. It's interesting that Corbyn and Saunders, who were, you know, kind of part of that wave, have now the old men, you know, the kind of grand old men of the movement now. And I guess it's the, you know, the younger generation who are kind of clamoring for this kind of return of progressive politics, of I guess a better deal, a kind of new, a kind of a change in the current kind of political setup that's really going to bring about the great storm, the revolution, the reform that everyone's so wanting. And I think the seeds of it have been seeded in the late 60s and the early 70s. Completely, yeah,
and you could kind of see the very early start of it back in the Beat Generation, back in the 1950s. You know, you could almost argue that Burroughs and Ginsberg and Kerouac, you know, they were the guys who got the ball rolling, don't you think?
Completely. I mean, you know, if you go back in history, I mean, you know, Soma in the Bhagavad Gita, Homer in the Zoroastrian religion, Manna in the Bible. I mean, the psychedelia really was a seed of really world religion, really, in a very significant way.
And I think you know, the biggest irony of the universe, of the planet, is that there was Burroughs, there was Ginsberg, the Beats. I think what really catalyzed it in a funny way was the CIA, back to the CIA again, you know, MK Ultra. I think it's a funny, almost like cosmic joke. But then maybe not. Maybe these were kind of mystic. No, maybe these guys were switched on, these CIA operatives, and they wanted to switch other people on. So maybe it wasn't such a kind of ironic happening after all, but it was actually systematic. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Think about Timothy Leary.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, like Al Pert. I mean, they were basically funded by the CIA initially in the Harvard studies, you know. So really, it's kind of, they kind of seeded in a really, very, very powerful way the kind of 60s counterculture. So it's funny. It's funny.
It is. It's an interesting subject. I mean, we were discussing it with Neil Saunders earlier this month in relation to the mind control and the use of chemicals, and also how the media portrayed that and the possible, you know, reasons for it. But I mean, another thing which has come up over, you know, the last year's bunker shows with a few subjects is non-locality or the transfer of information when, you know, the body isn't present, but the consciousness receives information that they can't physically receive. And Neil Saunders mentioned a little bit about that in terms of remote viewing, hypnosis and other ways of attuning to. So, you know, how do you think, you know, from your research that concept of non-locality or non-local information, you know, could impact, you know, and does it fit?
Okay, I mean, when you have a fractal brain theory, I mean, when you have a fractal brain theory, what it means is that if you have a fractal brain theory, and also a fractal universe that reflects a fractal brain, and the universe is one giant brain, what it allows you to do is actually understand that all consciousness in the universe is the same sort of consciousness, which is really a stepping stone for explaining that, you know, it's one that's the same sort of consciousness, but then to explain that it's all one consciousness. Okay, it takes a few steps to explain. But the big idea is that ultimately there is a higher mind, and that is the mind of God. So like William Blake, he said there is a kind of poetic muse, a kind of poetic genius that from which poetry and art comes from. But then he also says that's one and the same as the source of prophecy, i.e., you know, prophets talking from God. So I believe that you know, the source of scientific insights, of true art, of kind of prophecy, of these kind of visions come from this kind of higher source. And ultimately, it's the mind of God, and we can become one of that, or get little glimpses. But in a kind of fractal hierarchy along the way, we can get kind of expanded consciousness into a wider arena and get kind of like more local information. It's still non-local to our brains and our bodies, but it's kind of like expanded locality that's planetary, then, you know, kind of galactic, and then ultimately cosmic. You know, people on these in these mystic states or on psychedelic drugs, they keep seeing the same thing, the universe as a giant tree. You know, the people have seen this backward causation in the mystic visions all through time. So I think, yeah, I mean, definitely, I think the fractal brain theory, you can use it to explain the ultimate, that we're one consciousness that's ultimately, I know some people have problems with the word God, but this is what we're really talking about, the one all-inclusive totality that, you know, in certain states you can actually become one with. Then in between, yes, definitely all things, not all things, but many, many kind of things that baffle materialists and scientistic kind of militant atheist types will become completely apparent and possible.
And do you think that some of the ways in which, I guess, over the last 50, 60 years, that more chemicals have been available for people which can, you know, have a psychoactive effect on their consciousness? Do you think that's had an effect on I guess the deterioration of most of the traditional spiritual churches or places that people would go?
I guess there's been a resurgence of spirituality versus religion. And it sounds like, I used to work in a church, and I think it's, the churches really are about, about dominance and submission, really. It's about control, intercessing on behalf of God. And I think these direct mystical experiences have led to really an upsurge in the kind of like new Gnosticism, the kind of new neo-paganism, I guess.
At the same time, I mean, the story of Odysseus and the land of the Lotus Eaters is that it's the first port of call. So psychedelic drugs isn't the answer. It's not the kind of be all end all of the spiritual journey. It's just the first stage of the journey. And I think the moral of the story, and we're talking about, the most important story probably in Western civilization, the most important myth in the Iliad, we're talking about the classic of the classics. The gem of wisdom embedded there is essentially that, the story goes that the lotus eaters fall into a slumber, and the lotus, obviously, is a psychedelic plant. I mean, references to, in Indian Sanskrit texts, soma, the kind of mystical brew, was actually, it means press out and extract. Anyway, the lotus plant was actually referred to as soma. So at some point, the kind of mystics of India were using lotus as a kind of psychedelic. And also in Egypt as well, the blue lotus of the Nile, the white lotus in the Far East. So we know it's psychedelic. Okay, so the moral of the story of the land of the lotus eaters is essentially that the sailors of Odysseus go up to the island and they eat the lotus and they fall into this, they have their mystic states. That's not actually said, but it's kind of, in between the lines. But they fall into a kind of stupor and they get lost. They get trapped in that island. So they're stuck. And the only reason why they get out is because Odysseus comes along and he pulls them out of the island. The thing to learn from that story is basically it's the first port of call, but then what do you do with those mystical experiences? Like Alan Watts said, which I agree with, is when you get the message, hang up the phone. And I think it's, I'm not saying put completely, I'm saying basically it's limited what you can do with psychedelics. And I guess the rest of the journey, I would de-emphasize the psychedelic aspect. But I would kind of introduce other things. Yeah. Well, go for it. Yeah, you go for it.
I was going to say, so it's like any tool, it's what you're actually doing what you're actually using to do it with. So if you're, if you're having a hug, it's a brain body reaction. If you're watching some sport, it's a brain eye reaction. If you're speaking, it's a brain voice box reaction. So it always kind of comes back to the brain.
Yeah, and look at the way that allegedly primitive tribes use psychedelics. It's a rite of passage.
Yeah,
an opening to a different way of thought. So it's not taken lightly.
Exactly. Yes. With respect. Yes.
I was going to say, I remember reading a book by Paul Davies, who's, I think, Stephen Hawking's is or was his opposite number at Cambridge for a while at Oxford.
Oh yeah, Paul Davies. He's great. Yeah, awesome. Yeah.
And he was speaking about the formation of astral bodies, stars, and how they blow apart and regenerate. And he was saying that the mathematics involved was incredibly subtle and eloquent, and there was a great underlying art with that, so much so that he said that God is in the maths. And then it made me think when you were saying that actually when that first cell divides, actually that has within it the knowledge of the human being that it potentially is going to grow into. And so in terms of looking at that consciousness experience of when you can perceive things not necessarily in our usual space-time continuum, that insight is quite an interesting thing to get your head around, I guess, in terms of that potential, development of one's consciousness.
I mean, sorry.
Paul Davis is great. I mean, he's a great physicist. I think he's well respected by even some of your kind of mainstream militant atheists, big names. I mean, so he's very brave to actually explore the interface between physics and some of the more kind of esoteric aspects of religion, I suppose. I don't know if he's religious. I'd be fascinated to meet the guy at some point. But yeah, definitely more than most physicists, he does definitely explore themes which do border upon the kind of spiritual, mystical, and religious than most physicists. Totally, yeah. Sorry, what was your question?
Well, in terms of the understanding that we're all one consciousness, in terms of that perception, do you think that that's part of that sort of fractal insight that actually we have an awareness of what potentially our consciousness can develop into? As a young child, you know, its DNA would have some perception of how it's going to grow into it as an adult.
Well, I think as we kind of, you know, in the same way we kind of come from this emanation of a point of a fertilized egg, the universe, you know, emanates from a point. And I think the universe emanates it's from a point to create complex matter, to create a kind of this kind of scripted reality, this cosmos, that kind of gives messages to its inhabitants, little signs, that reminders of who we are. So I think you know, the universe inevitably converges back to the state of being divine, sacred, and perfect. But along the way, I think, you know, through world history, a kind of microcosmic representation of the universe is unfolding what's happening on the planet. You get prophets, you get saints, you get mystics and visionaries, you get bigger glimpses. But for everyone, we go through our lives, and I think through synchronicities, through the people we meet, and through little kind of strange happenings and little kind of like mystic insights and intuitions, I think we're kind of guided towards, if not in this life, then inevitably through, you know, successions of lives, we're guided towards back to that truth. And I think it's when you become open to it, and eventually when it's kind of broadcast and actually made kind of just known, and, you know, the kind of the hidden is unveiled and it's made explicit, I think it would accelerate that process of people knowing who they are and kind of gravitating back to that state. And actually then this, you know, these ideas, these experiences, then come to back to permeate society, like we were saying early on about the 60s and 70s. People had this experience of oneness and a kind of visions of a better world, and they became political activists, kind of seeded in a women's rights movements in America, in Western Europe, and a kind of, you know, kind of civil rights movements, and were inspired by this kind of vision from these kind of either directly or indirectly through these mystic states. So I think definitely, yeah, the universe is kind of like giving us these signals.
Yeah,
I think it's really a very special time because, you know, what's happening on the planet, what's the mess in society, politics. Sorry, you go for it.
It's not even that difficult a concept, really, because, you know, like, you know, just for an example, you know, like, I've never met you in my life, we've never talked before, but last night, yeah, you know, like, I had to listen to one of your interviews, and you mentioned, you know, like, right, Blade Runner. From that point, I knew you were kind of on a level, and it's just so many things, you know, I could kind of, I almost knew that I was going to kind of like get along with you. And, you know, like, it kind of doesn't surprise me at this point that we're having this conversation, you know, not even through, you know, like, if I met you in a pub, we'd be having this conversation. And, you know, I kind of clicked at that. As soon as you mentioned Blade Runner, as soon as, you know, one thing that really struck me was when you, you know, like said, you know, you kind of identified with Tyrell. You know, like when I was a kid, I was kind of like, yeah, Rick Deckard all the way. But, you know,
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, isn't it? But, I mean, in adulthood, I've kind of realized that actually Deckard was a bit of a prick, and actually maybe he could have been one of those replicants. So, you know, like, that whole kind of sequence of just, you know, like me lying in bed, having a listen to your interview, I kind of had this kind of, there you go. There was a cog in the machine just clicking right there, and here we are talking. Isn't it incredible? Well, fractal brain theory, like that.
you know, amazing. I mean, the funny thing is, Ridley Scott was inspired to make Blade Runner by George Lucas's Star Wars. So I saw myself as, you know, kind of like Tyrell meets Luke Skywalker in my teens. Okay, but the funny thing is, Dune, which is another huge influence, another modern myth, that inspired George Lucas. So a lot of the Tatooine stuff is basically Arrakis, you know, Dune. And the funny thing is, I mean, you know, the end of Blade Runner, I guess the director's cut is when, you know, Deckard discovers he's a replicant. So I can't wait for the next installment, you know, Blade Runner 2, that Ridley Scott's making right now. Yeah, I tell you, when I saw Star Wars The Force Awakens, I had a, you know, little mystical epiphanies because I was such a huge fan as a teenager. But, you know, seriously, George Lucas, kind of Ridley Scott and Frank Herbert are our homers, you know what I'm saying? They're our myth tellers. It's the fact that we have this kind of bond from these common narratives, these common stories. They are really the kind of like the, you know, the idea that societies are created by narratives and myths. So the fact that there is kind of this world myth called Star Wars, Blade Runner, Dune, they kind of, you know, a kind of composite story that many people like us have absorbed. It gives us, you know, it's like a common identity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so do you think that's a sort of a reflection of that sort of destiny wave function, that some stories are just sort of destined to be told, or some experiences or feedback loops are destined to be expressed as a natural way of things?
Well, seriously, in real terms, I mean, people might say, oh, George Lucas, he's just a creator of pop culture. But in real terms, he's one of these kind of almost like prophets. He's one of the servants. You know, prophet means to speak for the higher truth, the higher mind of God. So in a sense, in real terms, George Lucas has really been the Homer of modern times. He really has kind of like seeded ancient mythology. He's really taken the work of Joseph Campbell, basically, and has made it into these amazing movies that really kind of, well, changed my life, for one. And, you know, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if I didn't see Star Wars as a little boy. So definitely, yeah, I think the Destiny Wave function has, you know, kind of selected or kind of made people like George Lucas into kind of like important kind of messengers of the Destiny Wave function's, you know, unfolding of destiny. Definitely, yeah, definitely.
Well, it's incredible, you know, like all along the line with science fiction and, you know, like literary giants in general, you know, like when you think about, you know, literary culture, it's always kind of reflected, you know, like, you know, you think about dystopian novels, we're actually living certain elements of, you know, 1984, you know, as far as surveillance culture is concerned. Yeah,
it's,
yeah, you know,
like you're, yeah, scary.
Yeah, you look at Robert Heinlein and his take on Starship Troopers. Yeah, sure, we're not being attacked by aliens, but, you know, like, we're constantly under threat by an enemy. Dialogue and narrative that is driven by an enemy. And so, you know, like, it's just interesting how science fiction has provided so many of the basic archetypes that we're actually experiencing today and now.
And do you think some of those archetypes are reflective in the way, you know, AI technology and brain theory is developing?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, first let me say that, you know, the Dune thing, I mean, Arrakis is Iraq. The Fremen are, you know, the kind of Shia warriors. And, you know, the idea of the Mahdi in the Dune is straight from Islam. So definitely. And that's unfolding right now in, you know, the kind of Middle East. So, and, the funny thing, well, it's sort of science fiction. I mean, Back to the Future, when he comes back to this horrible future scenario, Biff, the kind of anti-hero, was actually modeled on Donald Trump, okay, who might become the next US president, most powerful man in the world. So, that's kind of like scary, but it's kind of like almost like mythology and kind of, you know, culture reflecting reality and vice versa. Now, with respect to the fractal brain theory, I think it's, you know, what I see, obviously, you know, like a lot of these kind of alarmists, I've seen, you know, Terminator, all these kind of like tech noir movies, and obviously, sci-fi writers and movie makers, they explore possibilities, and these are really are possibilities. But I guess it's also to take inspiration from movies like Star Trek and the kind of more positive side. Now, the unfolding of the fractal brain theory is that it's totally inspired, yeah, by I guess my absorption of myth and sci-fi and prophecy. So I see it very much in mythic and prophetic terms, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's so important. You know, like, I think that we do have as many Star Treks as we do Blade Runners and Aliens, because, you know, Star Trek provides an incredibly optimistic view of the world. And do you think there's any reason why, you know, like, science fiction and fantasy does always err on the side of dystopia?
Well, I think there is a tendency to paranoia in people, which is you know, it's important. I mean, the world can be a dangerous place. So I think and also if people are being fed, and also in the time of the Cold War, people were in a kind of fearful state. And what's happened with the world now with ecological, environmental, and political situation, people are in this kind of, you know, if you think about it, it's actually quite depressing. So I think that feeds into the kind of more tech noir kind of modes of looking at things. I guess you've got to give people a kind of more positive view, I guess. People pinning their hopes on Corbyn and Saunders because people know there's something really wrong. But I guess you've got to give people a positive vision, definitely.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, a year and a half ago, I mean, you mentioned prophecy. I mean, we spoke about the current political system. We also spoke about the current state system in terms of the law as well as politics. And part of that was that the paradigm and the choice at that time between Cameron and Miliband was very, very narrow. So since then, we've had the emergence of UKIP and Donald Trump in terms of that reactionary right. We've also had the emergence of Corbyn in the UK and Sanders in America that again has widened the political debate on the left. So, that's quite a subtle shift. Whether you know those people will be effective, whether they're positive is another discussion. But the fact that debate is widening, and you know, as we were looking towards some of those undercurrents expanding consciousness relative to the political and state systems that we have, do you foresee that continuing? Or increasing its rate of people being able to find expression with those things, or do you think that they may be shut down?
Well, people are looking for answers, and I said pinning their hopes on figures like Corbyn and Saunders. I think the real problem is that what's missing is that the incumbent powers have a very tight and very powerful narrative, and I tend to agree with the left-wing BBC filmmaker Adam Curtis, the power of ideas, the power of narratives. And I think the establishment have a really kind of tight nexus of ideas, and it's basically neoliberalism, via Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And selfish genes, Darwinism, and Ayn Rand, it's a really tight nexus. Ayn Rand, especially in America, the idea of absolute selfishness as a virtue. And unless you have a kind of competing narrative, then, you can have your constitutions, your political programs, and your agendas, and your social movements. But without that kind of glue, that Weltanschauung, the kind of like the kind of narrative, the kind of, I guess, the worldview that sticks it all together, then I think any kind of social movement's going to flounder. So I think, the idea of powerful narratives is that everyone's looking for this new story to emerge, but no one knows how to articulate it. So people have been talking about this paradigm shift for a long time. Even people like Ron Paul talks about a need for an intellectual revolution, a new cognitive map, a kind of a new way of doing things, a new vision. But the problem is no one seems to be able to articulate it. And all the while, the incumbent powers that be have this really tight and powerful narratives that's driving things like, privatization, driving the shrinking of the NHS, driving the shrinking of the state, especially in Western Europe and in America. So I think there is this kind of like search for answers. I think it's wrong to, not wrong, but it's probably limited to pin your hopes on people. I think it's really to see and to find this new narrative that everyone can agree upon that's going to be powerful enough to unite all these different factions, not just in Western Europe, but also the factions of Islam, and also in the Far East, I think, and in India. So that's what I think is the kind of long-term real solution, I think.
And when you've got those programs like that in terms of narrowing down the conversations, I mean, we mentioned earlier, I suppose, a little bit about secret knowledge and do you think secret societies also, you know, have a part to play in keeping that dialogue at a very narrow focus? As opposed to you know, a more consciousness expanding the narrative, I guess.
Well, I think there's absolutely always an interest in the powers that be to protect the dominant narrative because it keeps them in power, basically. So any new narrative will be challenged. As for secret society, I'll tell you a funny story. A kind of ex-neighbor of mine who it's the hand of fate. So I was living in this flat 10 years ago, and I found it in Loot, which is a kind of newspaper. And anyway, I see the guy recently, and basically I give him a copy of the Quest book. And in the back it says it's like a Dan Brown, real-life Dan Brown novel. It mentions Freemasonry and Rosicrucianism. Anyway, so my friend, my ex-neighbor, tells me, I've not seen him in a few years, he tells me he's involved with one of the most... Possibly one of the most esoteric Freemason sects in the country, and has been kind of biding his time to tell me. Isn't that freaky? And so I don't necessarily see. People have kind of mixed ideas about Freemasonry. I think it's going to be, you can't generalize about people and organizations. And I think the same kind of organizations.
Would you agree that secret societies and esoteric cults and such, you know, like their inherent flaw is the same as the, in my opinion, the inherent flaw of, you know, like organized religion is that it extrapolates the self's, the person's responsibility, the individual's responsibility onto a deity or another figure. So, you know, like, even though they've kind of got a grasp on the sacred geometries, they actually haven't got a grasp of the concept. And that's kind of like where your fractal theory kind of jumps in.
Oh, completely, yeah, completely. I mean, all human institutions and organizations are susceptible to corruption. And basically, you know, I did some talks with the Occupy movement. I knew a lot of the people involved. And the same games you see in church. I mean, I worked for a church for 10 years. And, you know, the kind of the same games, power games, and the same corruptions that occur in probably secret societies and religion also occurred in these kind of like, you know, radical left-wing movements, the Occupy movement. So I think definitely the thing about secret societies, it's probably prone to corruption because they are secret, and you can, you know, be corrupt. You know, you support your Freemason brothers who are on the council, you know, in the police or whatever, and you help yourself to help each other get promoted. Sure, that's part of human nature, but I tend to think that any kind of a faction or society or whatever can actually be turned towards the good. So I'm an optimist, really.
Yeah, and I mean, it's almost self-defeating to speak in terms of left and right, isn't it? Because, you know, you look at what's going on in the moment, say, around, you know, like American campuses, and there's a really kind of regressed push on the left. So, you know, it's kind of easy to kind of throw stones at a guy like Trump because he's like this big, fat, ugly ogre. But when you look at a bunch of, you know, like, fresh-faced, young, middle-class students, you know, like, kind of saying, I'm oppressed, it doesn't work. It kind of misses the point. So, you know, you kind of have to go with it. You have to roll with reason. And I kind of get with, you know, the whole fractal brain theory is it kind of rolls with the mechanics of the universe, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, all human beings, organizations, you know, are kind of like imperfect. I think, you know, the idea that astounding kind of new finding in genomics is that in every generation there's 60 point mutations that are not in your mom and dad, so you know, the really high mutation rate, so we're degenerating every generation, and that affects a lot of that affects behavior, you know, so we're actually physically, literally, genetically imperfect with each generation. And I guess what you need is you need ideals, you need basically, you know, you need like ideas that you know, survive people. So I think it's not about people, because people degenerate, people come and go, so you really need a kind of like an idea here, I suppose, yeah, a worldview, a kind of Weltanschauung that kind of survives and is actually less corruptible than people are and organizations and secret societies. And if you can actually revitalize the actual ideas of these secret societies, maybe you can reawaken the kind of values which set them up in the first place.
And I guess that's getting the information out there. I mean, last time we spoke as well, we mentioned that the left-right paradigm seems painted for the 21st century, the post-2012 world. And the paradigm is more based on liberty versus the control. And it, in terms of when people are exercising control in terms of social models and such like, do you think that that there's going to be that tension between whether it's left or right, but between people wanting their liberty and that control safety fear mechanism that often comes from, you know, those people who intervene in your life?
I think, if anything, the control structures of this world are trying to assert their grip, and with technology they are. And the one bright spark, the one hope, is the internet. And I think, you know, the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, and even Corbyn over here, would not have happened without the internet. And even Obama, you know, getting elected was actually largely to do with clever use of the internet. So I think, yeah, there is this kind of power struggle between the powers that be and, you know, those who don't want to be controlled and, you know, kind of oppressed and kind of like have their liberties taken away and their kind of, you know, inalienable rights denied. So I think this is really the kind of cosmic battle happening on the planet right now. So I think it's, I think this is really the kind of a key issue, but you have to make people aware of it. At the same time, you know, the 1% who are kind of accumulating all the power, all the money, the media, the banks, etc. At the same time, even some of these 1% of the people of the kind of very rich are exactly the kind of people who may fund a kind of movement that's going to, you know what I'm saying, turn the tables. So I believe that, yes, the people in control with the money and the power, a lot of them, some of them will be wanting to fund dynasties and kind of maintain that grip and to, you know, kind of launch kind of political dynasties that last forever for 1,000 years and et cetera. But at the same time, there are people like even like Paul Allen, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, you know, they have loads and loads of money. They are the people in control now who can actually, I guess, turn things around. So I think there is a kind of like battle going on, but it's not us versus them. It's really us all together trying to work our way to a kind of higher freedom.
Do you think, to a degree, you know, like we kind of rely on this kind of presumption that there's some, you know, like higher they who are future proofing for us, you know, on our behalf?
Sorry, a higher power who are controlling us. Sorry.
Well, you know, like, be it the government or be it, you know, like just the powers that be. Do you think that, you know, we just presume that somebody's taking care of where we're heading instead of, you know, like relying upon some sort of self-motivated vision of where we should be headed?
Well, exactly. I think you know, people can become kind of unaware, and I think it's also, you know, this is not conspiracy theory, but it's really it's in the interest of the powers that be and people to really not make people think too hard, because then they're going to question the system. So I think it's people need to be, I guess, woken up. I guess people need to be engaged. It's happening to an extent with this rise in, I guess, progressive politics, this rise in the kind of desire to kind of revitalize what was called the left in its original meaning of the word, not the its corrupt sense. You know, people saying it's correct that the left wing doesn't really exist anymore in a true sense. You know, progressive politics doesn't really exist. You know, it's a sham, isn't it? You know, if progressive politics was about against hereditary privilege, then the left wing is all about hereditary privilege and keeping it in the family now. So that's a bit of a contradiction. So definitely, yeah. So it's about revitalizing these values. Sorry, you go for it.
And also, I guess, you know, the ability to, you know, mutate and be diverse and experiment, as long as you know, you're not doing damage to yourself and others around you, because I guess that if you say, you know, there's 60 mutations from one generation to another, you know, right, then that those mutations, you know, some will be successful, some wouldn't be successful, but yeah. I guess that's how, as you know, an imperfect, you know, in Darwinist terms, evolving species, you know, that would probably be a necessity. So, you know, do you think there are sort of dangers with such things as eugenics or you know, population control systems?
I think, Fabrice, I think in the next 10, well, 10, 20 years with this technological singularity, with this CRISPR technology, genetic engineering, it's really going to be a brave new world. And it's a scary world. And unless we fix, you know, the human frailties and the human, you know, the what's wrong with the human systems now, then I think it's going to be a very dark world, because these powers, these new technological powers, are so powerful that if they enter a world where, you know, of political corruption, of humans not being able to control themselves and, you know, kind of maintain a kind of like equitable, just society, then once you introduce these other factors in, I guess it's going to be completely out of control. I think, you know, questions of machines taking over become irrelevant if, you know, the human society is such a mess anyway. And we introduce these, you know, kind of really world-changing technologies into a world where basically we can't, you know, even handle ourselves. It's going to be a complete disaster, completely, yeah.
Well, I mean, you've come up with some, you know, some excellent theories that give people lots of options to, you know, to put on extra perceptive glasses with reviewing themselves, their consciousness, and the world around them. But how have you sort of been received by the big brains in your field when you've gone to conferences and such like?
Oh yeah, I mean, what's many people aren't aware of this, but what's happening in mainstream AI? The idea is actually really old, and I think the ideas I rejected 25 years ago are exactly the same ideas that made a resurgence now. So I think a lot of the workers in AI now are really barking up the wrong tree. Now, it's funny, some of the, you know, kind of big names that I was kind of reading about, neuroscientists in 20 years ago, they write to me out of the blue. So I'm a very strange position of being a researcher who mainly outputs his work on video, on YouTube lectures, kind of live talks. And these, you know, kind of like really well-known scientists or well-known scientists now kind of write to me out of the blue to say that they really like my work. Funny, just the other day, a guy who runs a computational neuroscience lab in Oxford effectively asked me to join his team. They're all professors. So the mainstream is kind of like is in a state of not really knowing what's happening with the brain and artificial intelligence. That's why they say it's going to be 20 breakthroughs away. It's going to be, you know, 50 years away. We still might not have artificial intelligence and the brain theory. So it's kind of breaking into the mainstream to a certain set of more kind of innovative and broad-minded theoretical neuroscientists, artificial intelligence researchers. But really, the ultimate proof of the brain theory is really the creation of artificial intelligence and enter the world of commerce first, and then enter into the world of the mainstream science and AI.
And that's a really positive development that people are paying an interest and taking note of, you know, the cutting edge that you're putting forward. And we're drawing to the last few minutes in the bunker. If people would like to find out more about what you've done, I definitely recommend going and having a look at some of your YouTube presentations. And if they do, you just type in WAI H as an initial,
Sang,
and surname Tsang, TSANG, and they'll come up with quite a few there. You do have your own YouTube channel as well, and a website. The website, shall I do it, or would you like to, Wei?
Oh, yeah. It's basically, the website is www.iawwai.com. Basically, my name spelled backwards and forwards.com. And also, the book Quest is now on ebook format, so you can actually buy it on Amazon now. So just log on to Amazon, wherever you are, and just type Quest, my name, and you'll find it. So, yeah, so it's lots of new stuff coming out in the next few months.
Yeah, and that's great. So people can find your book, which is, I recommend. It's a literally mind-opening read. You're also on Facebook as well for people who do that.
Oh yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I mean, follow what I'm doing, latest updates on Facebook as well. Yes, definitely.
And I have one of my favorite questions that I ask people is, sure, just before we close, do you have a quick message for the people upstairs in Westminster who think they're in charge? do you have a little message for them?
You know, quite frankly, politics, there's a downward spiral. Each generation of politicians, it gets worse and worse. So I met Ed Miliband because his son is in the same school as my daughter. And I thought, God, is this the leader of the Labour Party? The next, apart from Corbyn, you know, the next bunch who are going to succeed his kind of, you know, Tony Blair agenda, were even on a downward spiral. And, you know, kind of like some of the kind of like Republican candidates that we've seen in the debates running for president, they make George Bush Jr. seem like a wise elder statesman. So I think, yes, I think Houses of Parliament, I think the state of politics in the UK now has really gone to a really bad phase. And really, we're seeing acolytes of kind of neoliberalism and this kind of like almost like a negative, retrogressive politics that's really almost tribal. So definitely, I think it's a terrible state of affairs. And I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I think it's you know, society is a very complex thing. It needs kind of sharp minds, it needs kind of clever people, it needs kind of switched on people to make the right decisions, and I don't see those people in the Houses of Parliament.
Hey, so yeah, need to sharpen up the guys upstairs. Thank you so much for joining us. Where it's been a real pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Yes, yeah, absolute pleasure. A very stimulating conversation.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, man. And we only just touched base, so let's get you back on at some stage.
That's fantastic. We could go on for hours and hours and hours.
Dark City is going on for hours and hours. Afterwards, after this show, we've got the Dark City Cannabis Compassion Club coming up. And then, as usual, tomorrow, Pax Mundi Show and Sarah. And it's good night from us all in the bunker. Good night.
Good night, all.
Good night.